This morning is United States against Hampton.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Ferris, and I represent the appellant Anthony Hampton. Your Honors, Mr. Hampton's case presents this court with a clear example of the dangers which arise when the government fails to question or corroborate the allegations of an anonymous and unreliable informant. The government in this case, although probably inadvertently, nonetheless handed over police investigative authority to a felon with a history of fabricating exactly the type of crime charged in this case in exactly the neighborhood at issue. There are three independent grounds upon which this court may vacate Mr. Hampton's conviction and remand this case, though none is more primary and important than the government's failure to establish reasonable suspicion sufficient to...
Have any response to or any description of the bearing of our decision in Wooden?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Decision in United States against Wooden.
I'm not familiar with Wooden, Your Honor.
A note on December 28. It considers and rejects all the arguments you're making here about reasonable suspicion.
I'm not familiar with that case. I can suggest that this case, like the Second Circuit's decision in Cologne, is a case in which reasonable suspicion was not determined by anyone competent to do so. No officer did so. In this case, the officers who actually made the vehicle stop, performed the vehicle stop and the search of the vehicle, responded merely because of a radio dispatch by a 911 operator. The government produced no evidence which would establish that that civilian operator was sworn or had training. Under
what does that have to do with anything?
Well, under the imputed knowledge doctrine as recognized by the Supreme Court and this court, some officer must establish reasonable suspicion.
It doesn't require any officer to establish anything. There's no such requirement.
Well, reasonable suspicion is necessary to stop and search a vehicle.
Look at the facts. That is, what did the, I guess there were a total of four 9/11 callers say. So those are the facts that are in. We need to determine whether they were reasonable suspicion in light of the applicable legal standard.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And of those four, actually there were five. There were three callers, one called twice, and the fifth was a call by Tony Smith. Tony Smith is the only caller who directs 911 or the police to the defendant in this case. It is the only information related to the defendant. And that call contradicts every prior 911 call. The first callers identified an individual in a black shirt with black
shorts.
What
would you have done if you had been the dispatcher?
Well, the dispatcher could have asked any one of four simple questions to identify whether this tip was reliable or should be.
You don't expect the 9/11 dispatcher to be conducting an interrogation of the caller, do you?
Certainly not, Your Honor, but this call lasted 11 minutes, and the 911 operator never asked the caller, who are you? Had that question been asked?
And they don't like to answer that question.
Okay. Who is he? The informant here claimed he'd known the defendant for 15 years. What did you see? In fact, the caller here did not see the crime alleged. In fact, at no point in 11 minutes did Tony Smith at any point allege that he saw a gun, that he had seen a shooting, that there was any criminal activity ongoing. In fact, he simply said that the defendant was standing outside of a building speaking on his cell phone. When police asked if they could send officers to Tony Smith's location, he said no. In fact, the 911 operator went out over the radio and communicated with an officer in the field twice.
Can you talk for a moment about the sentencing, the residential entry?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
What would be an example of a residential entry that did not create any possible danger? How does it differ from burglary in that respect?
Well, certainly, just on the language of the statute itself, I mean...
No, be concrete. Well, what would be a case where residential entry, as distinguished from burglary, doesn't endanger any, doesn't create any risk of bodily harm?
I could think of an example in which an individual enters a home or dwelling place of another where no one is present, where
that's
an alarm scares them away.
That's true as well, obviously, right?
Sure.
So what's the difference?
Intent.
You have to distinguish them.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
From the standpoint of endangering someone. A burglar generally doesn't go in intending to harm anybody. He wants to steal things. But, of course, the danger is there'll be somebody there. Now, why is residential entry less dangerous?
Specifically because if there was that additional intent, the crime charged would have been burglary.
Come on, that's verbiage. How is there greater danger of harming someone in a burglary case than in a residential entry case?
Well, again, there could be a number of ways. The burglar could be carrying a weapon. The burglar could.
So the person who's doing a residential. I want you to give me an example of a residential entry, which, because it's merely a residential entry and not a burglary, in other words, there's no intent to commit a felony when you get inside, is less dangerous. Because if there isn't any such case, then there isn't any reason to distinguish between them for purposes of classifying something as a violent felony.
Well, the distinction here has to be intent, Your Honor, because
otherwise... Well, you're
certainly
not answering my question. You apparently are unable to specify a case in which there's a... violates the residential entry statute, not the burglary statute, but is less dangerous, therefore.
Your Honor, if we take that to its ultimate conclusion, trespass is a...
Give me an example, would you please?
Your Honor, there are instances...
What's in the set of residential entry? I could imagine... In a potential divorce case, the husband hires a private detective to break into his wife's separate house and plant a bug. Uh-huh. So that's residential entry because it's a forced or surreptitious entry, but planting the bug is not a felony in Indiana.
Correct.
Now, is it your position that there's less risk of confrontation with the householder in that kind of crime than in burglary?
Whether or not there is less likelihood that you encounter a person, there is, based on the language of the statute, there is a missing intent element to actually do any sort of harm.
We know that, but there's also the existing intent element, that is, you intentionally enter.
Correct.
Right, knowing you're not entitled to be there. So I'm trying then to figure out whether if you look at the set of these cases, that is entry to do something in my private detective example, something that may or may not be privileged, or entry with intent to commit a misdemeanor, you intend to go up to the householder and slap him and leave, or you intend to go up to the householder and insult him and leave. I mean, is there any reason to believe that those offenses are systematically less dangerous, less likely to result in a violent confrontation?
Your Honor, for the purposes of counting this as a predicate, the only thing that I could tell this court is that were that actually to happen and there were to be any sort of violent confrontation, the individual would have been charged in Indiana with a burglary,
Look, just go back over my examples. You break into somebody's house knowing he's there. Your plan is to go into the living room, surprise him, and say, your residential security system is really terrible. You're a stupid fool, and then leave. You're not committing a felony by saying those things. You've committed the crime of residential entry. Is it your view that that is less likely than a burglary to result in the householder pulling the gun out from under his cushion and shooting?
Well, Maybe not, but then it is not the individual committing residential entry who is committing the violent crime. The predicate offense...
Have you read the Taylor case, the one that holds that burglary is a crime of violence? The rationale in Taylor was that generic burglary is a crime of violence because the householder may shoot the burglar, as well as the burglar may do something to the householder. There's no requirement that the injury be suffered by the householder. And, of course, under the doctrine of attribution, if the householder shoots the burglar is liable for his own shooting.
Yes, Your Honor. I recognize that. The Indiana statutes here actually define a violent felony, and residential entry does not fit within it.
It's so completely irrelevant what Indiana defines as a violent crime or not.
Well,
I wish you would address my question or Judge Posner's question or both, although they're variations of the same question.
I would simply say, Your Honor, that Begay directs the court not to look at the way in which the crime may be committed, but actually the elements of the crime. And in this case, the actual...
Exactly. And Begay says that what the things listed as violent felonies have in common is a purposeful aggression. And burglary is one of those examples of a purposeful aggression. You break somebody's outdoors and enter. And the question I'm asking is, in what sense is residential entry different? It sounds like a purposeful aggression in exactly the same way burglary is a purposeful aggression.
Without the same risk of harm because the intention element is lower.
But you keep asserting that without going through the set of things that are residential entry and showing why they are less likely to result in harm than burglary. Right? I've given you four or five examples of what might be residential entry because the intent was not to commit a felony. And it doesn't sound... My suspicion is that they are every bit as dangerous as burglary in the relevant sense. There may be a confrontation. Your sense may be different, but you need to either reason it out or supply data.
I don't have data to give you today, Your Honor. However, you know, if... We take this to the...
You're under the misapprehension that burglary requires an intent to harm somebody.
No, it requires an intent to commit another felony. That intent element is relevant, certainly, when addressing whether or not a crime is committed in a violent way, or whether it poses similar risk of harm, and the intention to commit an additional felony within someone's home presents a higher risk than simply the intention to get in.
I just don't understand how. The crime of burglary is committed if you enter somebody's house with intent to steal his copy of Dickens's Great Expectations. And you do. You go up to his bookshelf, you take the copy of Great Expectations, and you leave. Now, why is that more likely to precipitate violence than the case I gave you of entering the guy's house knowing he is there for the purpose of insulting him? And that's the crime of residential entry.
Your Honor, I understand the hypothetical being asked. I think practically that crime is charged as burglary.
It could not be charged as burglary. It does not satisfy the elements of burglary. That's why I gave it as an example.
So take a variant of Judge Easterbrook's divorce case. You're getting a divorce, and you break in order to remove your possessions from the house. Okay, they're your possessions. You're not stealing anything. Not committing a felony in the house. But what's the difference between, you know, trying to steal your own stuff back? It's like O.J.
Simpson.
Or, you know, stealing someone else's stuff, right?
Certainly, Your Honor. I understand the concern. I would urge the court not to read out the intent element in these statutes because the
reading out intent elements.
Well, the Indiana courts, the Indiana legislature has drawn that distinction and has, in fact, identified the what constitutes a forcible felony and what does not, and residential entry does not. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ferris. Mr. Ong.
May it please the Court, Winfield Ong for the United States. I'd confess that I am also unaware of the Court's decision in Wooden. Sounds like I should be, and perhaps it would aid me. But I will address the issue of a reasonable suspicion for the pullover, the stop of Mr. Hampton briefly as it stands in the briefs. There were five calls, the record's clear, over a period of about 5 minutes, two by one person, so four separate references or call-ins to a 9/11 about shootings in the area of 38th and Meridian in Indianapolis. This is an emergency, if ever there was one. These folks all cross-corroborate each other, all in the same area, all seeing things that are consistent with each other. Ms. Drawer, in particular, sees two black males, reports five shots. Mr. Adkins, one black male in a dark short-sleeve shirt with a gun. And then someone in the subway who hears numerous shots being fired right near the subway. Of course, then Mr. Smith calls in subsequently, and that's the source of attack by the defense. But the fact is Smith doesn't stand alone. It's the totality of the circumstances. And what Smith says to the 9/11 dispatcher, while extraordinarily detailed in itself, also is cross-corroborated by the ongoing emergency reported by the other people calling in. So in conclusion, this is model police work, I would suggest, about what should be happening. The 9/11 operator who is drawing out information from the people calling in and having an ongoing conversation with Mr. Smith about what he sees in an effort to try and apprehend these shooters that are firing shots and what appears to be not just, for that matter, aimless gunfire, but actual gunplay going on in broad daylight in a crowded residential area.
Well, on the residential entry issue, the sentencing issue, suppose someone is freezing in the snowstorm and breaks into a house that he thinks is deserted, but it turns out there's somebody there. Wouldn't a violent event be less likely than if he were a burglar?
Yes, I think so.
Well, isn't that a basis for distinguishing between residential, you know, unpermitted residential entry and burglary?
I think it's a basis to distinguish. I don't think it's a basis to find that it doesn't fit within the residual clauses still constituting a serious risk of violence. That is, I'm not going to argue that, you know, the intent to commit a theft or take someone's property upon the residential entry or the illegal entry might not heighten the sense of risk. Someone may be more likely to act violently if their intent is to commit a theft. Someone may be more likely to act violently in an effort to protect their personal property as opposed to a purely random entry still done intentionally. But I think it's the intentional and unlawful entry that creates a sufficient risk. This court is.
Is there any evidence of that? I mean, do we know anything about people charged with? Do prosecutors charge under the residential entry statute just to have one less element to prove, or are these systematically different types of case?
That's
you see how this would
sure.
be would be something for plea bargaining, right?
Absolutely. I think it
is. Government doesn't have to prove intent to commit a felony, and defendant gets a lighter sentence.
No, there's no question. I think it is. That's what struck me in this case. I don't know the underlying facts of Mr. Hampton's conviction, but would not surprise me at all if there was a plea bargain issue here and unsure of the elements of burglary, of the theft, or the intention, and pled it to residential entry, which still in Indiana does involve an intent element, and I suggest in this court's decisions of Gardner and Taylor fit all the necessary requisites also required by the Supreme Court in Begay, and that this court's analysis in Gardner and Taylor still apply post-Begay. Assuming that the stop was sufficient, then I think the evidence, the modicum of evidence supporting the conviction was more than sufficient. You add in Mr. Moore's elaborate testimony from the top of his apartment building, the bullets in the Murano that was in the parking lot, the elaborate testimony Mr. Smith provided at trial, all of which now come in at trial, and I would point out the transcript shows that there was, I think, very professional and close cross-examination of all these witnesses in same lines as brought out in the defense brief, and the jury rejected it. And I think there's ample reason to believe that the jury was on strong footing when it did. There were ample bases to convict Mr. Hampton of possession of this firearm. There are no further questions. That's all the government has. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.